يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to another Middle East Analysis, and quite frankly I don't know where to start because there's so much to talk about today. As usual, I'm joined by our Middle East expert, the consultant to the Bishops' Conference on that region, that's Dr. Harry Hagopian, international lawyer and commentator. Harry, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and good morning to you and to your listeners, James.
Well, as I say, Harry, lots and lots to talk about.
Indeed.
We can make a comment on the death of Osama bin Laden. I'd like to talk about Syria, focus on Syria and the situation there at the moment. The International Criminal Court, there are interesting proceedings going on now with regard to Libya.
True.
So we'll talk about that. And then, of course, a degree of Palestinian reconciliation between the PLO and Hamas.
Or in Cairo today as well.
Indeed. Harry, can we start with Syria?
Certainly. James, Syria is in bad shape at the moment. I mean, those of your listeners and all the people across the country who've been following on their television screens, on the radios, in the newspapers, what's happening, it is quite clear that at the beginning when the Arab Spring reached Syria, there were two options. One option was that it would go the Pacific way, that the President Bashar al-Assad would find a way to implement the reforms on the ground and to make them work and real, and that would basically stop any violent uprisings. Or the other way was the way that most Arab dictators think, which is to come down very hard on the demonstrators and basically, if I may use the word, swat them into submission. And unfortunately, although at the beginning it started with what looked like a mildly reformist agenda by the Syrian president that they had learned from the experiences of Tunisia, of Egypt, and certainly of Libya and Bahrain and other countries, and we were encouraged to see this happening, particularly since Syria also, as you might well know, has a very large Christian community living there of various confessions and denominations. We were encouraged by those reformist sounds, but then suddenly it looked like the president and the Syrian inner circle gave up on those reforms, and now all we hear about is tanks and elite Republican guards attacking demonstrators, massive number of arrests, detentions, no freedom of expression, foreign journalists are not allowed into the country, so nobody really knows exactly what is happening in the country. And of course, the symbol of this whole uprising has been the southern town of Deraa, which is in the Huran governorate, and it basically borders with Jordan, with Ramtha, and it is basically almost one tribe on either side of the border. But there are other demonstrations and confrontations happening in places like Banias, in places like Aleppo, even in Damascus, the capital, and certainly in the north, in places like Qamishli, which also has a substantive Christian and Kurdish communities.
I want to know, is this the president's fault, if you like, Bashar al-Assad? Or, you know, I read your latest article, Where Are the Signs of Hope in Syria?
Uh-huh.
And you're very careful talking about where sanctions are imposed and where the finger is being pointed. And we're talking here about al-Assad's brother and cousin. Why is the finger not being pointed at the president? Surely the buck stops there.
Well, it's interesting because if you continue with that article, James, which hopefully your listeners would also have access to on our website at the CBCW, you would notice that it's interesting, even when President Obama issued his executive decree with bans on travel and some other sanctions against some Syrian officials, he basically excluded the president from that executive decree. And the idea was, on the one hand, because we're not sure, we haven't been sure for a long while, whether the president himself is part of this oppressive inner clique, it's a clan basically, or whether he is a reformist and he is basically being checkmated at every corner by other people within the political circle who are not allowing him to implement the reforms he might wish to implement.
Well, is that sensible diplomacy on the part of Obama and others, or is that basically, if you like, an indication that they believe that he's just a puppet and isn't really in charge of that country?
Well, to a certain degree, they do believe that. There are many people who believe that he is a puppet. He's not in charge of the country. They believe that the country is pretty much run by his brother-in-law, by his brother, his younger brother Maher, and by his nephew, who basically control the Republican guards and the intelligence services. And I think part of it, James, is because there is this nostalgic view of the president, when we know that he's an ophthalmologist who has lived in this country, in the UK. He was here in London for a short period. His wife, Mrs. Asma al-Assad, who is not only British educated, but she's born in this country. Mm. So in a sense, we think that, well, surely our values of democracy, no matter how warped and disfigured they are, but we still have those values, that he might have carried some of those with him when he assumed the presidency in Syria. But there is another much harder reason why we're being lenient, I think, to date with President Bashar al-Assad, and that's because Syria is not Libya, Syria is not Tunisia. Syria is a hugely important strategic country in the region. Look at the files that it holds. You've got the Arab-Israeli conflict, you've got the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you've got Iraq, you've got Iran, you've got Hamas in Gaza, you've got Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. All these, wherever, whichever one of those files you look at, Syria has something to say about them. So if you suddenly get rid of the president and the whole establishment, the way we're trying to do in Libya, bluntly put, a regime change, then we might cause such a black hole that not only would Syria disintegrate into civil war, which could be tragic for everybody, including the Christian communities living there, but it would be tragic for the whole region as well. Hence the prudence, hence the diplomacy, hence why we're tiptoeing a bit, although we're beginning to up the ante, not only in the United States, including here in this country with Foreign Minister William Hague, but certainly in France, where they're now basically beginning to raise the tone as well.
Can we still treat Syria as a safe haven for Christians? We've often talked about Christians fleeing Iraq, as it were, into Syria. Is it still a safe haven or is it dangerous?
Well, there are still a lot of Christians. There are huge communities, Catholic, Orthodox communities across the whole of Syria. And in a sense, and I choose my words advisedly, James, I think that the Christian communities are not being targeted. Again, one of the things I have a big problem with is that when you prevent foreign journalists or independent observers to go into the country in order to observe and report on what's happening there, then not only you might not get an accurate picture of what's happening in the country, but the regime then cannot say, well, you are misreporting facts on your satellite channels and in your newspapers. Excuse me, if you want us not to misreport facts, then let us come in and have a look what's happening in the country.
But is it any better allowing foreign journalists into Tripoli and then sort of shepherding them into an area, an international hotel or whatever, and that's control though, isn't it?
That is control, but when you are there on the ground, no matter, I mean, you've got veteran journalists, they know their way around, they have contacts, they can see things in a way that you can't see when you basically closed off the whole country to everybody else, and you've just got reports of the army wreaking havoc with every single demonstrator, most of them without arms, who are trying to demonstrate against the oppression of the regime, who want reform, who want freedom, who want liberty. And in a sense, I think that what is happening in Syria at the moment is the cruelest of all that has happened to date across the whole Middle East and North Africa.
Now, Harry, you're not a prophet. I've got that loud and clear. But would you say, and I know you don't do speculation either, but would you say it's likely that there will be some Syrian Christians involved in these protests?
Again, to use your own words, James, you're absolutely right. I'm not a prophet. And just to please you, in my latest article, I say I'm not a soothsayer either. And I cannot really say, but I would think that whatever ordinary Syrian citizens across the whole country are facing in terms of socioeconomic problems, in terms of problems to do with oppression, with a lack of fundamental rights, I don't see why Christians do not also suffer from those prejudices as well. So in a sense, yes, the Christian communities suffer as much as the Muslims do, who are the overwhelming majority. Let's not forget, Syria is also roughly 22 million people. It's not a small country, it's a big country. And I think that whilst Christians have had, and I'm the first person to say this, and I've always said this, and I stand by it, that Christian communities have had, in relative terms, a lot of freedom in Syria in a way that they haven't had in other countries where there has been a much more oppressive religious, almost political Islamist approach to those Christians. Look at the Copts in Egypt, for instance, until nowadays. I think that inevitably the Christian communities, as well as the Kurds, as well as all minorities, as well as the overwhelming Sunni majority in Syria, would suffer from the persecution and the harassment that is happening at the moment.
I'm going to finish this segment on Syria, Harry, by throwing your own question back at you. Where are the signs of hope in Syria?
The signs of hope are dwindling. Hence, the question was not to infer that there are signs of hope and we just have to dig deep enough to find them. The question was, are we reaching a stage where there are no more any signs of hope? I refuse to believe that. I refuse to believe that based on my own Christian faith, because I believe inherently that hope is something that keeps us living and surviving and moving on. However, I also think that eventually, despite the suffering, that we will eventually get somewhere better. In a sense, if you were, since we're still living the Easter season, we're now in the Middle East and North Africa going through the crucifixion in many countries. Surely we as Christians believe that that crucifixion would lead to the resurrection. And in this case, in political terms, which of course impinges upon all communities across this vast region.
Let's turn our attention now to Libya.
Uh-huh.
And
to another trouble spot.
Absolutely. And let's start with the International Criminal Court and the prosecutor who's in New York reporting. Tell me a little bit about Resolution 1970 and the investigation into whether the protection of civilians will only come with the arrest of those most responsible for the most serious crimes.
Well, let me deal with the first bit, James, if I may, because the second bit is a little bit too dogmatic for any political thinker. What is happening in Libya, and incidentally, there are murmurs that the same thing might happen in Syria as well. So what applies to Libya and to Gaddafi and his inner clan might one day perhaps apply to Syria. Again, I mentioned that in my article. But it all started in February. I think it was the 26th of February. February of this year, when the United Nations Security Council adopted Resolution 1970. 1970 basically talked about violence against civilians in Libya and violation of their human rights. And what the Security Council did is that it referred this matter of the violence and the infringement of human rights of the Libyan civilians and the violence against them by Gaddafi and his loyal soldiers and mercenaries from the Security Council to the prosecutor's office. The office of the prosecutor is in The Hague at the International Criminal Court. Now, what happens is that the prosecutor, the chief prosecutor himself, Marino Ocampo, takes this resolution, this request from the United Nations, and then he starts approaching different organizations, both in the country, civilians, organizations, as well as other countries in the region, for instance, the Arab League, the African Union, the UN Council on Human Rights, then other states in the region, as well as people, Libyans themselves, living in the country, and makes an investigation to see whether those violations are indeed taking place. And then, following this investigation, then the chief prosecutor would ask a pretrial chamber at the court to issue warrants or summonses, as we call them, for those deemed most responsible for crimes against humanity. And that is basically what the prosecutor would be doing today. He would be reporting to the Security Council 2 months since the request was sent to his office to say where is he, whether there is enough evidence warranting warrants or summonses to come out because of the crimes against humanity being perpetrated in Libya. And then the United Nations Security Council would have to act upon that. Let me give you a comparable example, James. In 2005, the same thing happened when the United Nations Security Council, with 15 votes for and none against, voted for the same procedure with Sudan. And if you remember, then they issued a warrant against the Sudanese president, and all the story that happened after that. If I remember, that was in March of 2005, and it was Resolution 1593, I think. And then there were two warrants for the arrest of the Sudanese president, Omar al-Bashir. So in a sense, the same thing is happening now in Libya and might in the future happen with Syria too.
Does it lead to an arrest, though? Forgive my lack of historical knowledge on that particular
Well, point. This is where we have the grey area between law and politics. If you take the example of the Sudanese president, Omar al-Bashir, if you remember at the time, Ocampo, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, said he must be arrested, the warrants were issued, but then for political reasons, the Arab League and other countries came and said, no, we shouldn't arrest him because this would lead to more unrest, to more violence. It's not the right time to arrest him. So basically what we're talking, as you well know and your listeners would know, there's a vast difference between what the law says and what politics and politicians apply. So once the warrants come out, it's a question of what happens next. If it is in the interest of the politicians to implement the law, then the warrants would be implemented. If it is not in their interest, it will be there on file, but it will not necessarily be executed as and when.
So if, let's just say hypothetically, there is a warrant out for Gaddafi's arrest,
yes,
would it result in anything?
Well, it would result in something if the United Nations, through its various agencies, is given the right, first, to go ahead with the arrest, and second, the ability to go with the arrest. If you know, for instance, again, because this is a classic example and people would relate to it, if you take the Sudanese president's issue, the question was, when those two warrants were issued, he said he will not travel out of Sudan and therefore nobody could touch him. But let's assume that he does travel outside the country. Let's assume that he does, that security agents, we saw what happened with bin Laden in Pakistan. And there are many ways of enforcing a legal order, a warrant or a summons, if the political will were there. The question revolves around the political will to implement what the law allows us to do.
Fair enough. Do those warrants expire?
No, the warrants don't expire unless they are revoked. And what happens is that until they're executed or revoked, the chief prosecutor, every 6 months, would have to report back to the Security Council and say what has happened to date and report to them if anything has happened, if any headway has been made. But again, the headway that could be made is headway that could only be made if politically he and his machinery are allowed to do that. So in the case of Libya, for instance, what is expected to happen today with Ocampo reporting to the United Nations is that probably 5 warrants would be issued, or he would suggest 5 warrants for crimes against humanity that were committed by Gaddafi and forces loyal to him, mercenaries, etc., against peaceful protesters in the country. And I think that this would be, again, another red mark for him. Whether it would necessarily lead to his arrest tomorrow, certainly not. But the evidence is gathering. The noose is getting narrower and narrower, in my opinion. And despite the fact that the rebels are pretty much higgledy-piggledy, ragtag bunch of freedom fighters, and they on their own will never be able to take the whole of Libya, in my humble opinion. But I think that gradually between NATO, between the rebel movements, between between the international community gearing up, between the legal avenues that are being explored. I think personally, again, let me remind you and make you smile, I'm not a prophet, but I think that Gaddafi will one day have his time of reckoning.
It's interesting to look at this legal backdrop to what's going on in Libya. But on a somber note, you know, what is said in public or what is enforced in courts or what we see through the media and otherwise isn't always the truth on the ground. And we hear, whether it's true or not, again, I can't vouch for it, but in Misrata, we're seeing pro-Gaddafi troops in chemical protective suits and stuff, and yet he's supposed to obviously have decommissioned all his chemical weapon capability. So we have this in the background as well. So what is real and what is said to be real are two different things, aren't they?
What is real and what is said to be real are indeed two different things, James, and what is legal and what is political are also two different things, and we're living in a real world, so we have to be realistic. We've got to be pragmatic. There is that awful word that comes up every now and then, realpolitik, which means that we have to basically accept reality as we see it, not as we would wish it to be all the time. We can't be idealists in that sense. But I still would think that if I were to use one sentence alone that would qualify what the ICC is trying to do, be it in Sudan's case in 2005, be it in Libya's case possibly today, be it even in other cases, is that it is becoming increasingly clear to me that impunity is no longer an option, and that we are finally getting to grasp with the reality that we have to do something. And this is why I still cling to hope, why I still have a certain element of what a very famous Arabic writer called pesoptimism, which is a combination of pessimism and optimism. And I'm very pesoptimistic that we will be able to do something. And I hope and pray for the sake of the peoples of the region, ordinary, normal citizens who are being killed, who are dying, who are being orphaned, who are being arrested, who are being tortured. Rape is being used as a form of torture in some of those countries. Surely none of us, no matter how jaundiced a view we have of democracy and fundamental rights, would accept this to happen to anybody born in the image and likeness of God.
Hear, hear. Harry, can we move on to the Palestinians reconciling in Cairo?
Now, oh, yes.
I want you to explain something to me here. Again, forgive my ignorance, but I understand...
You're putting me on the spot again, well, aren't you?
I have to. I understand Hamas, yes, and its legitimacy now as a political party. Yeah. Explain Fatah to me in relation to the PLO.
Okay. You have to distinguish three bodies. You have to look at, first of all, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which is Fatah, which is the movement that basically represents the aspirations of all Palestinians for a sovereign, contiguous, viable state, independent state basically, called Palestine, on a territory that was occupied by Israel in 1967 during the Six-Day War. You have Hamas, which basically is an Islamist offshoot that came into being in the 1980s and gradually grew stronger and is now in control of Gaza. Then you have the Palestinian National Authority, which is that superstructure that was created during the Oslo Accords and the Camp David era, of which, if you might recall, we've had conversations since I was a negotiator during those negotiations. That superstructure is supposed to be the guide, the steering engine behind any negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. What is happening today is that the two constituent Palestinian factions, the PLO and Hamas, are getting together after 4 years of falling out, of not speaking to each other, of Gaza being pretty much disconnected from the West Bank. They're getting together in order to sign a document. So you will see the Palestinian president of the National Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, and you will see the supremo of Hamas, who usually lives in Syria, Khaled Mash'al, coming together in Cairo under Egyptian supervision with a lot of pomp and circumstance and signing the paper. Now, let me put two little addenda to this, James. The first is that this is not the first time they've tried it. They tried it in Cairo before. They tried it in Mecca in Saudi Arabia before. And each time they signed on the piece of paper or they came close to signing on the piece of paper, the ideological differences between those two movements made it impossible for them to reunite as one movement, as one people, as one aspiration in terms of what Palestinians would want. However, again, let me bring the element of hope in this and say, why am I a pessimist and not a pessimist? Why am I looking at the half full glass rather than the very obvious half empty glass? The reason I'm doing this is because the geostrategic dynamics of the whole region has changed in the last 5 months with all those popular uprisings. Egypt is no longer Mubarak. So therefore, the protector of the Palestinian National Authority is no longer there. So President Abbas and the Palestinian Authority cannot hide behind him in terms of their interests being secured. Correspondingly, Hamas has been also weakened because Syria has been weakened, and therefore Syria being one of the strongest supporters of Hamas as a resistance movement means that it too is weakened, and therefore circumstances have brought two weakened parties together in order that together they might form a stronger position. Add to that the fact that, unfortunately, Israel, instead of using this as an opportunity to move forward in peace, is using this as an opportunity to cast aspersions on Palestinian reunity, and also basically saying that the Palestinian National Authority president has to choose between reconciliation with Hamas or peace with Israel. To that, I have one simple question. If this were the real choice, then for 5 years, that's what the Palestinians have been trying to do without any quid pro quo return from the Israeli side. Unfortunately, what has changed suddenly that now the Israeli foreign minister or prime minister are suddenly saying it's a choice? No, there is no choice. And I hope that this sort of getting together again, this unity, would actually strengthen the Palestinian hand in negotiations for the future. Because let us not forget, Palestine, the Holy Land, is not only a political, demographic land. It is a holy land for us Christians, just as it is for Jews and Muslims. And therefore, for us at the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, we have invested so much effort, energy, time, sometimes unstated and secret, because you can't say everything. There are times when you have to do connections without talking about them, that we want to make sure that the Christian communities, the living stones living there, also have a good, promising future.
I want to ask you one question specifically about the Christians in Gaza. Mm. You talked about Hamas very eloquently. Will a more unified, a more cooperative Palestinian state, will it be better for the Christians in Gaza? Are they the ones that are kind of entrenched and vulnerable?
Well, I think that Christian communities across the whole Middle East and North Africa at the moment feel pretty much vulnerable because things are so much up in the air politically, James, that we don't know which way the winds will blow. However, you're absolutely right. Let's not forget there is a very small rump of Christians in Gaza. They're local Palestinian, indigenous Arab Christians, largely Orthodox or Catholic. But it's a very, very small community, only to be counted in the hundreds. That's all there is left. And in a sense, this reconciliation, it's a better word, I don't like reunification, this reconciliation between those two factions would inevitably make the lives of those few hundred Christians still living in Gaza much better, because first of all, it opens them up to the Christians in the West Bank and in Jerusalem. And in a sense, responsibility becomes clearer, more obvious, and the lines of accountability toward those Christians by the authorities, Palestinian authorities, would also become clearer.
Harry, you're not going to be surprised most probably about the topic that I'm going to finish upon, but it's just to have a quick word about Al-Qaeda, and in particular the death of Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad in Pakistan.
Oh, yes.
We're not going to talk necessarily about the definition of Al-Qaeda, what it means as a network, but if you would, give us your surface-level analysis on what this means for Al-Qaeda, particularly perhaps on its influence in the Middle East, if indeed it has any.
Well, a huge topic, James. Let me just share a few comments with you and with your listeners. Osama bin Laden was killed. That's clear. And it is quite clear to me, at least, that the task of the Navy SEALs was to go and kill him, not to arrest him. Okay, and he's been buried at sea. That's fine. So he's gone. But I think that Osama bin Laden had become a symbol rather than anything else for Al-Qaeda. A nasty symbol. A horrific symbol who was fighting the West, who was fighting what he called the Crusaders, i.e. the Christians, who was fighting everybody who did not subscribe to his own theology, which eschewed anything to do with fundamental rights, with freedom of expression or any kind of freedom, and basically wanted to establish a Muslim caliphate on this whole world. He's gone. Now, on one level, I can understand fully the reaction of the Americans, particularly those who lost relatives during the September 2001 attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, for that matter. I also understand that this symbol is gone. But at the end of the day, two further comments. One, he was only a symbol because Al-Qaeda has become an idea. It's not a regiment, a brigade, a Republican army that has different divisions. It's more of an idea with different affiliates. For instance, in the Maghreb, in Yemen, in other parts of the world, God help us, we probably have sleeper agents or sleeper Al-Qaeda members in Europe and the United States as well. So it's an idea, and these people react to this idea via the internet, via other means. It's not anymore a question of command and control, that he directs them. He doesn't direct them. He had a symbolic value because he was charismatic, because his past, this guy was a playboy. He had a pink Cadillac, and he used to go around in the 1970s having fun, enjoying life, drinking, women, and all that. Suddenly, he espoused Islam and the most austere form of Islam, which basically excluded everybody else, Muslims included, because Al-Qaeda hasn't only killed Christians or Westerners, it's also killed Muslims. And therefore, his background, also very, very wealthy Saudi family, so he forfeited his wealth, he forfeited his earthly pleasures and espoused this mission he gave himself. And what is this charisma and this background energized followers to say, wow, look at our leader, we have to follow in his footsteps, but not necessarily in the sense that he would send orders, attack this spot or attack that spot. And interestingly enough, one of the first things they said in the news when they talked about, when President Obama talked about his killing, is they said they couldn't find any mobile phones or any kind of internet or any kind of IT. Why? Because he wanted to make sure that nobody from the satellites could actually pinpoint to his place, although I find it hugely, hugely difficult to believe that such a mansion with such high walls built practically near the Pakistani equivalent of our Sandhurst military camp, or the intelligence services, by the way, are also a couple of kilometers down the road, that nobody knew what was happening behind those walls. But in a sense, the symbol has died, but it's only a symbol. Tomorrow, Qaeda is not going to disappear. The terror and the havoc that it can wreak upon the world will not disappear, but it is wounded, and a wounded animal is sometimes more dangerous than one that is not wounded. But let's push this a little bit further, and here I get a bit more controversial. The Holy See, the Vatican, came up with a statement saying that we Christians do not condone or condemn or applaud or praise any killing. I take that on board, because if you look at it, what have we done? We have basically done two things. We've applied the Old Testament principle of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and the whole New Testament is out of the window. Secondly, we have probably been in breach of God knows how many international law conventions by going into another country and killing somebody on the territory of another country. So in a sense, both from a strictly religious perspective and an international law perspective, I know there are people who will interpret it differently. There are different views on this, but my view is that it's questionable on both those levels. However, you want my honest opinion? I'm worried about the consequences of killing Osama bin Laden, but I'm happy that somebody who did all he's done is no longer with us, and may his maker judge him and deal with him as he sees fit.
Yeah, I understand completely what you're saying. But there is, isn't there, something a little bit uncomfortable for us as people of faith, thinking about someone getting shot through the eye and somebody, for instance, like Saddam Hussein in Iraq, you know, seeing him with a noose around his neck and being hung. On one aspect, you can understand why people would celebrate that. But yes. On another aspect, it's deeply uncomfortable, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you see, James, this is what I like about you. I spent 5 minutes trying to express that thought, and you summed it up in 2 seconds. That's exactly what I was trying to say, that on an almost primitive gut level, we are happy that somebody like him is no longer alive and he's been made to pay for his crimes. But on a higher level, we must also feel uncomfortable, not only legally, but also on a faith level, about just going and killing anybody, because there's a beautiful Arabic saying, Al-A'maru biyadillah, which means life is only in God's hand. And we became gods who deprived a human being, no matter how much of a scumbag he is, no matter how much of a criminal he is, of his life. Are we entitled to do that? I leave that as a moot point, because I do not assume I have the maturity or the knowledge to answer that question.
Me neither. What I would say is we've pushed on into a full-on radio program here. We're a good 35 minutes into this podcast. Harry, we'll leave it there. Thank you ever so much. Some really good insight there. I'm going to give you the final word.
The final word is very simple. I would like to ask everybody to pray for those Christian communities across the Middle East and North Africa, because they are going through uncertain times like everybody else. They're our sisters and brothers in Christ. They might have different complexions, they might have different names, they might have different cultures, but they believe in the same God. They actually celebrated the same resurrection all together. And so please pray for them, and pray for their well-being.
I can't add to that, Harry. Perfectly put. And thank you for your time. We'll catch up with all of this and much more next time.
My pleasure, James.